Afternoon, I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, May 8th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Crox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records and Zach Lawhorn with the LIO, Clark Bickford, staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have a packed schedule and committee. We're going to start off by hearing from Danette Schloeder, who is being considered for the Board of Nursing. Then we will hear for the first time House Bill 146 and House Bill 143. We'll finish the meeting by hearing the Senate versions of two bills that we've already heard previously in committee. Starting with Danette Schloeder, who is being appointed to the Board of Nursing. Please put your name on the record. Give the committee a brief introduction and tell us why you want to serve on the Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danette Schloeder, and I'm seeking reappointment to the Alaska Board of Nursing. For the past 28 years, I've worked in progressive perinatal roles, including a labor and delivery nurse and a perinatal clinical specialist. I spent my entire career working to improve the outcomes of women and newborns. I currently specialize in the care of high-risk pregnancies. I've spoken nationally on topics such as obstetrical hemorrhage, hemolytic disorders of pregnancy, and substance-affected pregnancies. I serve on the Alaska Perinatal Quality Collaborative and a national task force, making recommendations for reducing severe maternal morbidity and mortality. I'm also a clinical nursing instructor in an online program. I have 5 academic degrees in healthcare and nursing, the last being my Doctor of Nursing Practice in 2022. I'm a second-generation Alaskan. My grandparents were part of the original colonists in the Matsu Valley. My parents instilled a love of public service, which has inspired me to seek a board appointment. In my 4 years on the board, I've been the chair for 3.5 of them. Most of my board service has been during the pandemic. Our board worked hard to address the ever-evolving practice issues complicated by the pandemic, which and also have been able to move ahead with some strategic initiatives, including telehealth regulation and advisory opinion updates, creating a path for military corpsmen to challenge the LPN exam, and creating an alternative to discipline program for caregivers with substance use disorder. I am proud of the work the board is doing to advance the practice of nursing and meeting our mission of public protection. I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Do any members of the committee have any questions for the Representative Fields?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, hi, Ms. Schloeder. Are you a member of Providence Management? Is that what it means when it says clinical nursing director?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I no longer have a management position at Providence. I was the director of the Children's Hospital for 9 months, but I changed that position in February of this year.
Okay, maybe if I could ask a follow-up, could you describe where you are within the organization at Providence? To whom do you report? Are you a union member? Are you not a union member? What is your current job? Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Fields. My job is a perinatal clinical specialist. So I work primarily in the maternity center, and I report to the chief nursing officer. The position I have right now is not included in the bargaining unit. And as I stated previously, I do a variety of things, mostly is in education and care of high-risk pregnancies, and then also some process development, some policy development, interdisciplinary care management for patients in critical care or who are presenting with high-risk obstetrical conditions.
Thank you. On a separate subject, if I might, Mr. Chairman, or I can wait for other members, actually.
Are there any other members that have questions for the testifier? Representative Sadler?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to ask, I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing the witness's words. Is it possible to turn up her volume so we can hear her more clearly? Thank you.
Mrs. Schloeder, if you could please speak a little louder, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Certainly.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Schroeder, thank you for applying and serving. You've been on the board, you said, for the last 4 years?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that's correct.
And I guess my question is whether the board is working on things that the legislature needs to consider, or are there some things that the board would like us to consider?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, the Board of Nursing currently supports House Bill 149, which is the Nurse License Compact.
Okay. Anything else that we should be thinking about?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I'm not off the top of my head.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you again for applying.
Okay, anybody else? No? Representative Fields?
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Schlater, on a separate issue, Alaska statute prohibits anyone other than a licensed physician from providing abortions. Nonetheless, abortion access is protected in our Constitution. In other states, advanced practice clinicians can provide medication abortions. What do you think about Alaska's law limiting access to abortion in terms of licensed providers? And do you think that given that abortion access does have a relationship to an issue that's important to you, maternal health, do you think that we should have advanced practice clinicians have the ability to help provide medication abortions? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, as I stated before, I have spent my entire career trying to improve the outcomes of women and newborn. As a member of the Alaska Board of Nursing, I follow the statutes in helping create regulations. I'm also familiar with a scope of practice for advanced practice nurses. If that statute was to change, the Board of Nursing would create regulations for advanced practice nurses to safely perform to the fullest extent of their scope of practice.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Separate topic, Ms. Schlater, on training in Providence. As you probably know, Providence invests very little money in training nurses, which I think may relate to our nurse shortage. Have you advocated within your own employer to invest more money in expanding our nurse pipeline from within the state?
Mr. Chairman, I kind of object to that. I don't know that it's important that we get into Providence's business practices.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would just note
Chairman, I would second that.
I would just note that the individual serving on a board here has used that board position to promote a bill that is a priority of Providence, so I think the issue of Providence's position on these things is actually already a matter of debate, not through my choice.
I'm going to allow the question. We've given great deference to committee members to question in the past, but caution Representative Fields to try to stay on topic. Go ahead, Mr. Schloeder.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, there are lots of things that I'm aware of that Providence is doing to support training nurses. Nearly every nurse that is trained in the state of Alaska and actually in other states who wants to practice in Alaska receives all of their clinical or the majority of their clinical time is spent in Providence. So that's Providence employees and Providence leadership allowing and ensuring that nursing students coming here get the best clinical experience. Also, they have a transition to practice program. So any new nurse hired into Providence is trained and supported for the first 12 months of their practice. So monetarily, as a clinical nursing instructor, I think the nation could do a lot to help support the training and practice of nursing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let the record reflect Representative Sadler joined us at 3:17 p.m. And thank you, Mrs. Schloeder. I'm going to open public testimony on the slate of governor's appointees that we have noticed on the agenda. So public testimony is open. I see no one online. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on any of the noticed governor's appointees? Okay, seeing none, I will close public testimony. Representative Prox.
Mr. Chairman, in accordance with Alaska Statute 39.05.080, the Labor and Commerce Committee held hearings on the following appointees: Dana Walukowicz for the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, John Corbet, Jonathan Dart, and Anthony Ladd, Lake Williams on the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Brenna Hardy, Glenda Ledford, Board of Nursing, Danette Schlater, Board of Nursing, Danette Schlater, Board of Social Work Examiners, Stacy Sloan, Board of Dental Examiners, Megan Ferguson, and Jesse Hawken, Newell Walther on the Marijuana Control Board, Walker on the Marijuana Control Board, Ellie Cyrus. That was kind of clumsy.
Thank you, Representative Prox. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the report. We're back on the record. Moving on to House Bill 146, a bill by request of the governor. We have Lisa Parrington with the administration. Please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin.
Good afternoon. For the record, Lisa Parrington, Acting Legislative Liaison with the Department of Public Safety, Chair Sumner, and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for hearing the bill today, and I will be going over a quick overview of the bill and the sectional, if it's the will of the chair. And we also have the State Fire Marshal, Lloyd Nakano, that should be available online to address any questions or concerns the committee may have. So with this, the House Bill 146 is related to the state regulation of fireworks. Chapter 72, Title 18 of the state fireworks regulation bill or statute was first created in 1969, and it has not been substantively modified in almost several decades since then. And with that, the codes that we currently have in statute do not currently align with the International Fire Code and the National Fire Protection Association codes, which are kind of the standards for the national and international standards regulating the sale, use, distribution, and definition of fireworks. And with this statute being out of sync with those national and international standards, it's causing difficulties and challenges for the state fire marshal to enforce the laws, for the wholesalers and retailers of fireworks dealers to be able to comply with the laws. And with this disconnect, it can ultimately harm the public because you have this disconnect on what the requirements should be. Certainly the vendors are trying to meet the national and international standards, but our state law isn't currently up to date on those standards. So what HB 146 proposes to do is to move the requirements for the regulation of these to the regulations and move them out of statute. And so the bill would require the Department of Public Safety to implement the regulations specific to and in compliance with the international fire codes and with the National Association of the National Fire Protection Association codes. Trying to avoid acronyms, I apologize. And so that's basically what the bill will do. It also requires the municipalities that may currently have municipal codes and ordinances on the books to to comply with what those regulations would be. So it would move compliance with the state statute to moving to compliance that the municipal ordinances could not be less restrictive than what the department would adopt in the regulations. It does allow for the department to charge fees. The current statute allows for the charge of the fees for the retailers and the wholesale dealers, and this would comply with that when it moves into the regulations from the standards. By moving it to the regulations, it allows the Department of Public Safety to more readily adopt to the changes in the fireworks codes as those are changed at the national and international level so that we can maintain better synchronicities with those standards and to make it easier for the vendors to comply with those standards.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Purrington. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mrs. Purrington.
Yes, sir.
We've heard a lot this session about international or national standards and so forth. So if you can characterize the difference, or not the difference between, but what are the new international standards or approaches that are being proposed to be adhered to by the state? What's the international standard and how are they different than what the practice is in Alaska now?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, if it's the will of the chair, I'd like to defer that to the state fire marshal that should be online to better answer that question.
Mr. Nakato, please, sorry if I mispronounced your last name, please put your name on the record, and if you heard that question, you could please address it.
For the record, my name is Lloyd Nakano, State Fire Marshal, through the chair, Representative Sadler. The International Fire Codes and the National Fire Protection Association Codes are kind of, it's two different entities. We in Alaska adopt the international codes as a basic. In those codes are also adopted National Fire Protection Association codes. With this fireworks bill, we would also use other standards such as the Pyrotechnic Association standard, ATF standards, and also the Consumer Product Commission safety to get better aligned with fireworks in the nation and in Alaska, sir.
Follow up? Sir, through the chair, I'm not quite sure. You cited a couple different codes. I'm not quite sure if you can characterize. But first of all, you said that the International Fire Codes, the State of Alaska adopts them and includes the National Fire Protection Association codes. That may absolutely be correct, but that doesn't really tell me much about what the proposed change is. I'm trying to get some idea what the national, international standards are versus what Alaska has now. Are we getting more strict, more loose? Help me understand the qualitative difference in regulation that we're discussing.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we will not get more, it will be aligned more with current fireworks standards. In the International Fire Code is very limited on fireworks compliance, and using this other code would better make, will allow us to better, for the industry, fireworks industry, for compliance. On this bill was moved forward, and the industry, fireworks industry, is pushing for us to get regulations to be updated to a more current standards.
Okay. And through the chair, I'm not sure if it's a fair presumption that the more current standards are more restrictive or tighter. Are they?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't think it is more restrictive. I think it's going to bring better meaning when we talk about fireworks and make it, for instance, back in 1969, certain definitions for fireworks and the fireworks today have a different meaning.
Okay. Thank you, sir. So I think I hear what you're saying. It's just going to be more modernized to more accurately reflect the state of the industry now, not necessarily more or less restrictive. Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you are correct.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Representative Fields. Thank you. Through the chair, I was just curious, given that I guess the sale of most fireworks is not legal right now, I was curious if we nonetheless track the number of fires that are started by fireworks and if there's any data from other states that have legalized or made fireworks more widely available, what the corresponding impact was on wildland fires and sort of the urban interface. Is there an example that we can look to gauge how many more fires are likely to start because of, I guess you could say, errant or careless use of fireworks? Thank you.
Through the chair, for the record, Lisa Purinton, acting legislative liaison. Through the chair to Representative Fields, again, we'll defer to Fire Marshal Nakano to see if he has any of that information. I don't know that we've researched that specifically, but we can certainly look into that if he doesn't have that answer.
Fire Marshal.
Through the chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Fields. We would have to get back with you on that, sir.
Great. Could I ask a related question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I'm curious if any other states have explored essentially a fee to cover the anticipated cost of dealing with wildland fires. I'm sure there will be some increase in cost. It is a growth center on our budget. Unfortunately, I'm curious if there are models out there to make sure that we're having it be as close to a user fee type of situation as possible if we're going to go down this road of sort of broader fireworks use with corresponding cost impacts to the state.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, could you please repeat that?
Yes, through the chair, Fire Marshal Nakano. My question is, are there other states that have been successful in assessing the increased incidence of wildland fires trying to understand the cost of that and then establishing some sort of fee structure so that the companies that are selling these things are essentially having a user fee to pay for the cost of ultimately dealing with the unanticipated impacts of broader fireworks use?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I would have to do research and get back with you on that.
Okay. Could I ask another question about safety? Through the chair, Mr. Nakano, I'm curious if your office tracks injuries related to fireworks. I actually grew up in the South and have a lot of experience with fireworks, and don't know what the data are in terms of injury rates, and just would want to understand that from a public health perspective. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, we do have burn injury reports mandated, and we can research and get back with you on that.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Representative Carrick, and then Representative Chief.
Thank you, through the chair. I have a few questions. The first is just, maybe I'm missing a document, but is there a summary of changes from the original version of the bill to the House State Affairs CS, or can a brief summary of changes be provided?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, yes, the summary of changes was to address the concerns in the last committee, specifically related to the Section 2 of Subsection C, which is on page 2, lines 7 through 10. There was a concern about the way the bill was worded as it related to the entry of buildings where fireworks were stored or kept, which is in current statute. The committee wanted to add the last sentence there that says this subsection may not be construed to authorize entry into a private residency in which fireworks may be stored for personal use. So they wanted to make that clarification on the record, and I apologize for not having that for you earlier.
Thank you, and I have a different question, Mr. Chair, if I might. Thank you, through the chair. I'm a little unfamiliar with what municipalities in Alaska currently place regulation on fireworks. Do all municipalities have some sort of regulation around this subject, or only some? And could you just provide a little bit of context on what's currently the case around the state?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I We'll defer that to the state fire marshal. I know that Anchorage municipality does have codes on that, but I'll defer to the fire marshal for a more extensive overview of that question.
To the chair, Representative Carrick, I know for sure the municipality of Anchorage and other areas such as Juneau, Kenai, Soldotna, do have their own regulations. As for the entire state, I would have to research that and get back with you on that.
Thank you. And just as a follow-up through the chair, if you could please get back to the committee with where in the state currently has some kind of regulation around fireworks and where doesn't, I think that would be really helpful for the committee. And I do just have one more question, Mr. Chair, if I might. Is there some current code or standard either on the national or international level that Alaska might, through the Department of Public Safety, look into adopting with this legislation? In other words, is there something out there that's a potential model for what Alaska would do should we pass this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, other states do have, and we'll be researching that as we write the regulation.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Through the chair to the fire marshal. So it hasn't been researched yet whether there is some national or international fireworks code or standard.
Ma'am, I could talk to you earlier. Through the chair, Representative Carrick, as for the international standard or the national standard, it's a group of different standards that we'll be using to write our regulations. It'll be according to the Pyrotechnic Association, the Consumer Product Commission Safety. We'll also be using the alcohol, tobacco regulations. And that was brought up by us, by the fireworks industry to use.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Fire Marshal Nakondo, how rapidly does the fireworks industry evolve or change? I'm just not sure. I've heard the argument that we need to have regulations because it's maybe more agile. But I'm not quite sure how often things change, requiring quick change in regulations. I hope you understand.
Representative Sadler, we actually have a representative of the fireworks industry for invited testimony. Oh. Perhaps that would be
very good.
Yeah. So we will take invited testimony from Robert Hall, owner of Gorilla Fireworks. If you're on the line, Mr. Hall, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Robert Hall. I own Gorilla Fireworks, and we live in Houston, Alaska. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Mr. Hall. Please proceed with your testimony.
My wife and I own Gorilla Fireworks and in Houston, Alaska, and we've been selling fireworks also in North Pole for almost 40 years, coming up on our 40th anniversary. And we've been working very closely with the local fire officials who have very, very intense regulations of use of fireworks. And we've encouraged the state fire marshal. What the main purpose of this bill is, it would allow the state fire marshal to update the 50-year-old definitions of saleable or consumer fireworks, which don't include any clean definitions of the technical terms that they used 50 years ago. And that's caused a lot of concern within the state fire marshal's office. In that time, the last 50 years, the industry and the national regulatory agencies have made substantial advances in the safety of fireworks through regulations regarding the testing, the construction, the labeling, in many, many different ways, leading to much, much safer products. The injury rates have dropped dramatically. Good regulations allow stronger, and good definitions allow stronger regulations of those fireworks that have a higher fire potential. In Houston and North Pole, we don't sell everything. The local fire chiefs, with good definitions, we have loose definitions, so they kind of say, well, don't sell this, but there's not no clean definition. If this was adopted, we're assuming, and you might want to have the take a look at what he intends to do in the meantime. But right now, fireworks, there's no national standard. You had fantastic questions. You guys just asked just spot on. Lots of really excellent questions. There is no national standard on fireworks. The Consumer Product Safety Commission regulates, you know, labeling and some areas of construction and tip testing and make sure they're stable. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Association, DATF, DOT all have their own set of regulations on construction and shipping. And there is no model statute out there. The last state to take a look at this, I think, was Michigan. And when they legalized, they're the 48th state to allow the sale of fireworks. But not all states allow all fireworks. Good definitions allow the local regulations. My fire chief would love to have better regulations and more better definitions of what items are allowed so we can more easily restrict the sale of fireworks. Same thing in North Pole. This would not make anything more safe. This would not increase the amount of fireworks that are sold or allow the sale of more fireworks. Actually, it would restrict it, which is a good thing. There are some fireworks that shouldn't be sold in certain times of the year in certain fire conditions, and this would allow the state fire marshal to be able to give definitions that the local agencies could use, or perhaps even the state fire marshal to restrict the sale of some items. There's also there's also kind of a loophole in that Alaska 50 years ago adopted the term 1.4G fireworks, which is an international shipping regulation, and it limits fireworks. But over time, the international code has drifted a little away from what we do in the United States. And actually, there are some fireworks that are labeled 1.4G, which many people consider to be consumer fireworks, which were never intended to be sold to the public. And under some recent international shipping definitions, those fireworks are now being combined and sold internationally with what we consider Consumer Product Safety Commission approved type products. And BATF is holding national hearings right now on what to do with this dilemma of these new fireworks kind of entering into their larger, more powerful. We don't have that problem in Alaska because the current wholesalers are sticking to the so-called approved definitions, although currently the feds are letting each state decide what they want to do. The state fire marshal doesn't have that authority under the current definitions, and he should give some clarity to where he wants to go. I recently testified on a panel put together by BATF for regional, and they're trying to look. They don't want to jump into it. They're hoping that CPSC or DOT or somebody, the pipeline people, will. But there is some dilemmas out there. It's not a problem right now. In other states, it is an issue. But currently, the state fire marshal is correct. There's one of the terms used in is pyrotechnic composition. And that's a real technical term, and it's not easily, and as we get 50 years away from when it was first adopted, it's harder and harder to find the references 50 years ago, what they used for these technical terms. So the hope is, you know, it'd be ideal if the legislature would take this on, but we understand it's very difficult to get time from the legislature to work on these technical things. And, you know, it's unusual for the industry to say, please give the state fire marshal all the authority to clean this up. But it's the only way it's practically going to happen. There's no way the legislature would take the time to dive into this lengthy process and clean it up. And it's going to lead to cleaner definitions, better regulations. It'll also give the regulatory authorities that if they want to restrict products, which they do in Houston all the time, they do in North Pole all the time, it'll give those local agencies and perhaps the state fire marshal the authority to restrict the more wild, crazy aerials that could start fires and save those for the winter. So it's not intended to restrict anything right now. It'll lead to much cleaner, less confusion in the state fire marshal's office and allow the local jurisdictions to have better regulations to restrict the sale of fireworks and potentially in the future in some areas of the state where the fire danger doesn't justify anything but a safe and sane fountain, the state fire marshal would have the clean definitions to be able to step in. So those of us in the business for 40 years and we need safety sales, we need strong regulations. It's a little bit like alcohol. Fireworks are not toys. You need to have good, strong regulations. And this is a huge step, and it's the one step the state fire marshal can't take because the definitions are in statute. He can write all the regulations he wants, but the definitions are 50 years old, and we need to either adopt by reference the national standards of what, you know, the Pipeline Hazardous Material and Safety Administration does, what CPSC does, what DOT does, what BATF does, and adopt those as a baseline, or just take the wording of those and adopt that. And then, while they're not tweaked dramatically on a regular basis, they are, we're always, as a national body, trying to make fireworks safety. So every year or two, there's another labeling or test, or someone finds a way around something, and we come in there and restrict that. So the goal is safety, and safety sells. So it's not only a personal goal, but it's a business goal, too. And this would kind of make our rules kind of in compliance with the federal standards, which would make it a lot easier on the state fire marshal.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on my previous line of questioning just to ask either Mr. Hall or the fire marshal, how rapid, I guess the question I'm going to ask to both of you is, well, the essential question is, do we actually need to give the authority to the fire marshal by regulation, or do we simply need to have a statutory update? I'm not saying every 50 years is the proper schedule, but the need to update something that's 50 years old in statute, you were suggesting a paradigm shift to giving the fire marshal authority to regulate by regulation. My question, I guess, is how rapidly does the fireworks industry evolve, and how agile and frequently do the regulatory mechanisms need to be? Is statute insufficient? Is regulation necessary?
Can I go first? This is Robert Hall.
Go ahead, Mr. Hall.
The industry would prefer that the legislature took this on, that we're perfectly happy because of the concern that the state fire marshal's office, that the legislature wouldn't take the time that's needed to adopt by reference. And we think that's the way to go. Would be one way to go, like Michigan, where they just adopted by reference all the federal standards, and when CPSC standards change, theirs changes. But the state fire marshal field, and we concur, that this would give them the flexibility to add those little particular tweaks to Alaska law. And we're comfortable because it's so bad that while it's very unusual for the industry to say, you know, give the authority to the state fire marshal's office, the definitions that we have up here are so archaic and lead to so much confusion that we'll take any of it. So it's, you know, you take your choice of which way to do it. It's something that needs to be done. If the thought was, we've tried to update the statutes, I think State Fire Marshal is going to help me, like three or four times in the last 15 or 20 years. And there's always been so much other bigger pressing issues. This is stuff with the state to deal with the legislature that they hadn't taken the time to go through it just because it's fireworks and there's so many other pressing issues. So both ways would work. This would be the cleanest and simplest and the most practical way to do it is to trust the state fire marshal not to abuse their discretion and live with it. But that's our life. So it's a very good question, and the clean answer is let the legislature do it, but does the legislature have the time?
Fair enough. Thank you. And a follow-up question, an earlier question I asked in response to another question that was asked. In Alaska's current statutes, does the state hold the manufacturer or the retailer of a firework responsible for the costs of responding to a wildland fire that was caused by fireworks? Or does the law hold the person who lit the fuse liable for those costs?
It particularly is individual responsibility. We're required to post it right on there that anybody that starts a fire is liable. And we're supposed to tell them what the laws are, and we tell them exactly what they are. But the state relies on individual responsibility. that, but now the local cities charge pretty big permits. You know, Houston charges us $5,000 a permit, and sales tax goes straight to the fire department, and there's a fee to the fire department up in North Pole. So locally, they do collect some additional revenue for the fire departments. But the state is an independent, responsible type of thing, and if you start a fire, now if we were negligently to sell to a drunk or something like that, the fireworks stands have been found liable in those situations. But generally, it's up to the individual.
Mr. Hall, thank you. It's good to talk to someone with your degree of experience in the industry. Appreciate it.
Representative Prox, and then...
Yes, thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Hall. I'm familiar with the Guerrilla Fireworks stand in North Pole, and I think it was Guerrilla Fireworks that put on the show last Christmas, which was great. But my concern, I guess, is that there's relatively few places that sell fireworks when it's 40 or 50 below. Does that condition cause, will this cover this, or will this perhaps get in the way of your ability to sell fireworks during the New Year's?
Well, thank you for the good words about the city show at North Pole. It's one of our public services. Last year, we donated shows to many communities, all the high schools in the valley, and did the state fair show for free, and we're doing it again this year, and also the Arctic Winter Games. We use it as a form of advertising, and honestly, we all like to shoot fireworks, so it's a way in the off season to. But thanks for that moment. I don't know that it would change much about selling fireworks in the winter. That's the best time for fireworks. There's little fire danger and it's dark out. Our partner, North Pole Christian School, up in North Pole are pretty hardy folks. And if you live in North Pole or Fairbanks, you're a pretty hardy person if you made it through one winter. And it's just, weather dependent. Down here, we're building the store. It's a 15,000 square foot store. We got State Fire Marshal adopted almost 50 pages of new regulations for fireworks stores where people can go indoors, and we have indoor bathrooms in the winter. And our hope is to have one in North Pole in someday here. We're thinking 3 or 4 years. They have now water that goes by, which makes it the water system in North Pole because of the, I guess they had some problems with the plant that produced gas, and so it polluted it. So now we have water everywhere, which makes it easier for the sprinkler system water supply, which is one of the big factors. So I don't think this regulation would change at all anything about whether we sell fireworks or not in the winter. It'll just sell which products we sell. And it'll do nothing but make it stricter. Right now, the regulations are kind of general, and this will make it specific. It will make it real easy for all the wholesalers and importers to know that they're meeting the national standards, which will make it legal in Alaska. And if Alaska decides, like 30 states do, to limit some products sometime in the year, it'll make it really clean on which ones they want to regulate and when they want to do it. It set the stage for local regulatory agencies to do a better job of restricting the sale of some products at some time if that's what they choose to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. And then Representative Fields, and then we're going to have to wrap this up.
Thanks through the chair, Mr. Hall. I think I maybe had a misunderstanding about the bill and appreciate you clarifying that it would seem to increase fireworks oversight. But I hope that you could provide some additional detail on, you gave the example of aerial fireworks. Are those currently allowed? I was actually not aware of that. So just some detail about how this would improve it. I would appreciate it.
Well, I don't want to get political, but the fireworks that are generally federally legal are allowed to be sold in Alaska year-round. It's up to the local jurisdictions if they want to restrict them. In Houston, the more dangerous self-propelled, as forestry told us a long time ago, if you could just not sell rockets and missiles before green up. Well, the city of Houston went further, and we just got rid of all rockets and missiles, and so has North Pole, during the summer months when we sell them when the snow's on the ground. And those are items that can fly 200 feet. They don't have to go straight. They could land in the woods. They could start a fire, an unintended fire that could grow and turn into a major wildland fire. Small backyard type of things, fireworks where dad's shooting fountains or aerials that go straight up. They're not self-propelled. If they start a fire, he stomps it out. They put some water on it. Last year, there was two fires of 0.2 acres, I think, that burned in Alaska. Since we've started selling fireworks in Houston and North Pole, the North Pole, they noticed that there was a dramatic decrease in the amount of fires because they banned the sale of rockets and missiles, some other items. The fire chiefs went through the stand, thought things were too wild, said don't sell them. And so people no longer drove 40 or 50 miles to Salsha to get their fireworks. They just got what was legal locally. And it turned out, and this is true nationally, that you actually can encourage the safer use of fireworks by restricting what's available. In Houston, it's all dependent on the weather, what we can sell. We start off with getting rid of the rockets and the missiles, and then if we have to wait until after green up and a bunch of rain, we can open. And then this fire chief looks at the weather. He's talking to forestry all the time, and he determines what we can sell at that period of time. And then when he gets projections of weather increases or decreases, he can make adjustments. It's a lot of work and a lot of responsibility that Houston's taken on. And they worked really closely with forestry when they initially set up these guidelines 20 years ago. So it works, and, Alaska is a very big state, diverse. It's when state fire marshal tried to adopt some statewide rules years ago, the villages, the people lived on islands and stuff, thought that, this isn't appropriate for what we're doing. So the only potential concern is those areas that are unincorporated with no regulatory authority, and there's no local control. But that's just an issue, a general Alaskan issue that you may or may not want to address, but that would so complicate the bill and bring in opposition it may never get through. Our hope is to take the one step this year and clean up the definitions and give that state fire marshal the authority to modernize our regulations, or at least our definition. And then by regulation, the state can decide how they want to. But this is the first step, because it's in statute. You just can't automatically update the regulations without a change in the statute.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for a future date. We will take a brief at ease. The record, moving on to House Bill 143 from Representative Tom McKay. Representative McKay, please put your name on the record and begin.
Thank you, Representative Sumner, Mr. Chairman of the Distinguished House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Tom McKay. I'm Representative of District 15, and today we'd like to present to you House Bill 143, which is a House Resources Committee bill that would put into statute a regulatory framework for a new industry known as advanced recycling. Classic recycling technology is very limited in the type of plastic it can process. At best, we are currently able to recycle roughly 10% of the plastic that is collected and sorted. Advanced recycling utilizes chemical processes to break down used plastics into their chemical building blocks for the use of creating new plastics and other hydrocarbon-based products. This bill does not require any sort of investment from the state. It simply clarifies terms in statute that are used in the advanced recycling industry and designates the DEC to write regulations that abide by the language in House Bill 143. 23 other states have passed legislation similar to House Bill 143 in bipartisan fashion. As part of Alaska's open for business attitude, I would urge my colleagues to support this legislation, which encourages technological innovation, could create new manufacturing jobs, and promotes low-emission hydrocarbon products in an economically viable manner. I'll now have my Chief of Staff, Trevor Jepson, present the bill and the sectional analysis. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Mr. Jepson.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Thank you, Chair Sumner, and the rest of the House Labor and Commerce Committee for being here today for this presentation on HB 143, which would put into place a regulatory framework
to allow the fledgling industry of advanced recycling to operate in the state of Alaska. So advanced recycling, also referred to as chemical recycling, is a relatively new technology that turns discarded plastic that can't be recycled mechanically into petroleum-based products. As a commercial industry, it's been around for roughly 10 years, with a recent push for large-scale commercialization in the past 5 years or so. There are multiple reasons as to why we are seeing this growth in the industry now. From further research and analysis, we're finding the technology to the passage of legislation similar to HB 143 in other states, which has led to regulatory stability and billions of dollars flowing into the domestic advanced recycling industry. Using advanced recycling, we can convert non-recyclable post-use plastics into valuable products such as building blocks for new chemicals, feedstocks for new plastics, plastic additives, waxes, and lubricants, and fuels as well. But in recent years, the industry has moved away from fuels, making up the majority of the products created in the advanced recycling industry, and nowadays plastic feedstocks are the primary products. So, if we take a look at this flow chart here and start on the bottom, we have post-use collection. That's the stage in the process where plastic has been collected and cleaned. Typically, that plastic can only be mechanically recycled, with less than 10% of it being able to be recycled mechanically. The rest of it usually ends up in a landfill. Advanced recycling can utilize that other 90% of recycled plastics and turn them into petroleum-based products. It's important to note that this industry is not dependent on government subsidies and is economically viable without them. And also, advanced recycling is not meant to replace mechanical recycling, rather complement it. So next, we'll go into the processes that advanced recycling uses, which are also defined as terms in the bill. There are a multitude of chemical and thermochemical processes which can break down plastics into their building blocks, but the processes used in advanced recycling are gasification, pyrolysis, and solvolysis. We'll go over the definition of those terms in the next slide, but the important thing to take away here is that these are non-combustive processes, so you should not be thinking of an advanced recycling facility as akin to an incinerator facility. And while there are emissions associated with the advanced recycling process, they're well regulated and can be controlled through technological and operational practices, just like other types of manufacturing plants. As mentioned in the last slide, the three primary processes that the industry uses to break down plastics is gasification, pyrolysis, and solvolysis. Gasification uses high levels of heat in an oxygen-deficient environment to prevent combustion, with the primary product being synthesis gas. Pyrolysis uses heat in an oxygen-free environment, and the primary products are petroleum liquids such as naphtha, which is a building block for new plastics. And solvolysis uses solvents and sometimes heat to break down plastics into purified polymers. And the most widely used technology of these three in the industry today is pyrolysis to produce naphtha. So we'll go over that a little bit more on the next slide. So here in this flowchart, we have illustrated advanced recycling through the process of pyrolysis, which uses high levels of heat in an oxygen-free environment to break down used plastics. So if we start in the bottom left-hand corner at NU/consumers, we can go over the chart. We're starting at the point where plastics are collected, washed, and sorted. Those plastics would then be shipped to an advanced recycling facility where they would be ran through the facility's advanced recycling manufacturing system, and the output would be large volumes of naphtha. Naphtha is a precursor to plastic and would be sent to a cracker or plastic resin producer facility where it would be further decomposed into ethylene and propylene, which are the raw materials for plastics. These plastic resins are then transferred to plastic making facilities where they are used for new products. The question you might be asking yourself is this technology necessary? If you care about efficiency in recycling, conserving landfill space, and low greenhouse gas hydrocarbon-based products, then there's a strong argument that it is. The EPA currently estimates that only 8.7% of plastics that are recycled in the United States are reused, with the rest being landfilled. This number does not fully account for plastic that is thrown away or ends up in the environment as pollution. So the true recycled rate is probably much lower than this number. And the number is expected to drop even further as we continue to produce plastic in the coming decades with no capacity to recycle it. Other countries such as China are no longer taking our trash, so the result is that our landfills are filling up faster than ever, and we expect that trend to exacerbate unless something is done. Advanced recycling could prove to be a key part of that solution. So advanced recycling also fits into what's known as the circular economy, where through policy and technology, we can incentivize markets to reuse products on the largest scale ever seen in human history, allowing waste to be used more efficiently or returned to the economy as valuable products. So here we have a summary of the estimated economic benefits associated with an advanced recycling facility. But since models are only good as your assumptions, we'll first go over what those are for this analysis. So for the purpose of this economic model, we assumed one advanced recycling facility in the state and roughly 60,000 metric tons of landfill plastic in the state, with 50% of that being available for an advanced recycling facility. The total landfill plastic data was estimated based on our state's population share of the total U.S. population, with the weighting factor applied to account for the estimated recycling rate of 8.7%. The economic modeling software used was M-Plan. So in this model, we see a direct effect on employment of 100 jobs and payroll of $10.4 million and a total economic output of $34.2 million. In addition to their direct impacts, we see downstream employment, both indirect and induced, of another 150 jobs. And similarly, we see additional payroll of $10.5 million and additional output of $36 million. Just to clarify a few terms here, the indirect effect refers to business-to-business purchases in the supply chain taking place in a region that stems from the initial input purchases. And the induced effects are value stemming from household spending of income after taxes and savings. So in summary, advanced recycling is a low greenhouse gas emission process that can be used to turn petroleum-based products from what would normally be landfill plastic. In doing so, it can drastically decrease the amount of plastic taking up landfill space while increasing the amount of plastic that can feasibly be recycled. Finally, we'll see economic benefits to our state if Alaska engages in this industry. That'll conclude the presentation. Chair Sumner, we can now take questions or go into the sectional.
Why don't we do the sectional and the invited testimony, and then we can take questions. So go ahead and proceed with that, Mr. Jepson.
Sounds good. The sectional will be really quick. We see Section 1 designates the Department of Environmental Conservation with the power to develop manufacturing regulations related to advanced recycling. Sections 2 through 6 provide clarification that certain definitions currently in statute do not apply to advanced recycling materials, products, and facilities. Section 7 provides new definitions to define advanced recycling and the chemical processes associated with it. And Section 8 provides for an effective date.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jepson. Next, we have invited testimony from Craig Cookson. Go ahead with the American Chemistry Council. Mr. Cookson, go ahead and put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Sumner. For the record, my name is Craig Cookson, with the Senior Director of Plastic Sustainability at the American Chemistry Council. I'm here today to talk. We are a national trade association representing almost 200 global companies engaged in the chemical industry, including the leading manufacturers of plastic resins. I'm here today in support of House Bill 143, which would appropriately regulate advanced recycling and manufacturing. Increasing sustainability and reducing plastic waste are extremely important for our communities. This includes enabling innovation to drive recycling rates upward. To date, Alaska and much of the United States have been able to mechanically recycle things like soda and water bottles, milk jugs, detergent bottles, and some tubs and lids. However, it is challenging to mechanically recycle complexly engineered packaging such as food pouches, snack wrappers, and yogurt tubs. Additionally, economics, market demand, and recent restrictions from China have had a major impact. So this is where innovation comes in. Instead of sending these valuable plastics to landfills or burning them for energy, Technologies like advanced recycling, also commonly referred to as chemical recycling or sometimes molecular recycling, can take these hard-to-recycle plastics and convert them into raw materials to produce new virgin equivalent plastics and chemical products. These are truly circular, environmentally beneficial solutions that do not combust or burn the plastic material. So I want to just give a couple examples of how these technologies have been successfully implemented and deployed in the U.S. Wendy's has switched from their plastic-lined paper drink cups to an all-plastic cup made with 20% recycled plastics thanks to advanced recycling. Herbal Essence is one of the highest-profile brands of Procter & Gamble, producing 5 shampoo and conditioner bottles made from 50% certified recycled plastic. And companies such as Warby Parker and Under Armour are bringing recycled materials to the eyewear industry via advanced recycling technologies. And many of these are also certified by the International Sustainability and Carbon Certification Plus program, ISCC Plus. If Alaska converted just 50% of the currently landfill plastic feedstock in a state utilizing advanced recycling, it could generate over $70 million in economic output each year and up to 250 jobs in the state of Alaska. And you heard Trevor go more deeply into those numbers and how they are derived. As manufacturing facilities, these technologies are also subject to federal, state, and local environmental regulations, including the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. It is also important to note that 24 other states have passed very similar laws to ensure that these technologies are regulated as manufacturing. Lastly, it is critical for advanced recycling companies looking to invest in Alaska that their technology be properly regulated as manufacturing and that the products they produce count as recycling and towards any sort of future recycled content targets. HB 143 accomplishes these objectives. It paves the way for Alaska to be a national leader in reducing plastic waste. In closing, we're asking for your support of HB 143 to help bring added investments and jobs in the state of Alaska while increasing recycling, conserving resources, and reducing plastic waste. With that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Cookson. Are there any questions for either the bill sponsor or Mr. Cookson? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm all for making it easier for some other industry, but it will cost some to develop the regulations and et cetera. And you mentioned that 50% of Alaska's plastic generation plastics generated in Alaska could be recycled. Does that account for the transportation? I'm just wondering if there is a viable industry to start up at this point in Alaska.
Representative Prox, through the chair, as far as the economic model goes, I would probably defer to the ACC, but from to Mr. Cookson with the American Chemistry Council, so I'll let him speak a little bit more to the model, but researching the bill and looking at this industry, even if right now the correct economic conditions weren't in place, this is also just trying to get this in regulation. So in the future, if it does become economical through a new trade route or some sort of economic activity, then the state of Alaska would be prepared to partake in that through regulation. But if we want to speak more on the assumptions of the model, I'll defer to Mr. Cookson for that.
Thanks, Trevor. And through the chair, Representative Prox. Right now there isn't very strong demand for a lot of the non-bottle plastics, your pouches, your films, your tubes. And the reason for that is because there isn't sort of the technology well deployed that can take these plastics and turn them back into these chemical feedstocks that Trevor talked about in his testimony. And, you know, what we're seeing, you know, both globally through the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and also in the United States through the U.S. Plastics Pact, is over 100 global companies have committed to include much higher levels of recycled content in their packaging. Many have committed that by 2025, there'll be 30% recycled content in their packaging. Additionally, we're seeing states like New Jersey and Washington and California and others pass recycled content mandates. And so right now, the economics line up very strongly as the price of recycled plastics are much higher. And so that's pulling in, from a demand standpoint, investment. That's why our members have committed over $7 billion in announced investments just in the last few years towards advanced recycling. So to answer your question, yes, there would be cost to any sort of transportation, collection, things like that. But there's demand pull that will help monetize the system. You know, if you don't have a market and that demand pull, you know, you don't have an industry. So it's really key that Alaska enable these technologies to take root, and that you'll have that demand pull.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very interesting bill, so thank you. I was curious, maybe this is for the ACC or the bill sponsor. In these other states, the 24 or so, did their statutes set out sort of sideboards on air or water emissions? Did some of them set a baseline beyond which a department could further regulate, or what does that look like across the other states?
Representative Fields, through the chair, I would defer to the ACC as far as the legislation in other states. That would be Mr. Cookson again.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields, you know, the legislation in other states is, you know, I don't want to say exactly identical, but nearly identical or very similar to what you're seeing here in Alaska. So then it's up to, you know, each state's Department of Environmental Conservation or Department of Environmental Protection or Department of Environmental Quality to then make those rules. You know, on the subject of emissions, and I'm not sure if members of the committee have seen it, but there's a company called Good Company that's based out of Eugene, Oregon. They worked very closely with a company called Agilex in Tigard, Oregon for years. And they modeled the emissions of these facilities and found that that these facilities have very low emissions. So almost akin to universities and hospitals or other manufacturing facilities that produce things like potato chips and things like that. So I would say that the legislation is pretty much exactly the same, but it depends upon the state makeup of what happens next at the department.
I have more questions. I'm happy to wait in line for other people.
Representative Fields.
Okay. Thanks. I guess this question is probably for the ACC invited testifier. Why does defining this as manufacturing versus letting it proceed as a form of recycling make a difference in terms of industry viability? Through the chair. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields. Thanks for the question. Is, you know, when these facilities, especially in a sort of a newer fledgling industry, come into a state, there's kind of four critical things that they need to do to have a viable business. Number one, they have to work with the state and local governments to find a suitable, you know, piece of property, right? A site that is zoned appropriately, likely light industrial. Number two, they have to line up all their feedstock agreements. There's a lot of plastic out there, and Trevor characterized well that there's, you know, even in Alaska, there is a lot of plastic that is generated, but it's not all generated in one place. So working with different feedstock suppliers to line up that plastic feedstock is important as well. Number three is once you've produced, and Trevor talked about this, a naphtha-like oil, you have to line up your offtake agreement, right? So where is that going to go to then become new plastics and chemicals again? And finally, number four is lining up your investors. And, of course, we know the importance of timing in investment. So the key thing is for a company to really look at a state, they want to make sure that the regulations are appropriate for what they're doing. And the solid waste regime in which, you know, some would like to regulate these technologies is just not applicable. Technologies that are regulated under solid waste are taking garbage, mixed garbage, and they're either burying it or burning it. Or they're a materials recovery facility that's sorting, you know, cardboard from paper, from glass, from plastics, from aluminum. What these technologies are doing are receiving a sorted, and segregated plastics and then using a chemical reaction, heat, and chemicals catalyst, and taking the plastics, heating them without oxygen until they melt, and then heating them more until they turn to gas vapors, and then cool and condensing them. And then so they, you know, and then they're selling that raw material to a chemical manufacturer. So the operations and the way you regulate those facilities is totally different than solid waste. And so what the companies are concerned about is number one is, you know, sort of any type of delays from going down the wrong regulatory pathway, and what that might mean to the sort of the four factors I listed. And then number two, you know, the state of Alaska wants to best protect its citizens and to wants to regulate these facilities as to the nature of what they're doing, not to what they're not doing, so that you can best protect the citizens of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, is DEC online?
We do have... Hang on. At Chair Sumner, we should have Christina...
Yes, we have Christina Carpenter with Alaska.
Okay. Well, as a follow-up, I'd like to ask Ms. Carpenter, through the chair, the test of fire reference, sort of the regulatory landscape, either in the absence or with this bill. And I'm curious what Ms. Carpenter, how would a company that wanted to do advanced recycling, as described in this bill, get permitted now, and what current statutory or regulatory roadblocks are there? Thank you.
Mrs. Carpenter, yes. You go ahead.
Hi, this is Christina Carpenter with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Through the chair, Representative Fields, you were asking about any sort of existing permitting structure for advanced recycling facilities. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, currently DEC does not permit advanced recycling facilities in the state. We do have the authority to issue permits, but we've never exercised that authority. And you know, we appreciate the clarity in this bill, or it's always welcome to have some clarity in this bill about how the legislature may want these types of facilities regulated by DEC.
Thank you.
I apologize. Can I ask a follow-up? I guess I don't understand, Ms. Carpenter. Or do you feel like you can tell industry with confidence now how the regulatory process would work, or would you not be able to tell a company that wanted to invest here what kind of regulatory landscape they would be looking at? That's what I don't understand.
Okay, I apologize through the chair, Representative Fields. We do have the existing authority to issue permits to recycling facilities currently, but we do not currently do that.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Fields, through the chair, just to add on to that, in our conversations with DC, it sounds like they believe they might be able to permit them, but the larger issue comes on the investor side, whereas we're just not going to see anybody invest the dollars required it takes for an advanced recycling facility unless it's very clearly lined out in regulation what they're going to be facing in the state for business climate.
Okay, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just a little unfamiliar with recycling in Alaska in general, and can you provide a little bit of information on how much of any plastic material is being recycled in Alaska? I know we mentioned about 8.7% of plastics. Is that statistic true in Alaska as well? And when we talk about volume, how much are we talking about in terms of actually recycled plastics in Alaska currently?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, I do not have that exact number on us. What is the exact amount of plastic in the state? Which is why for the economic model, they use that estimate based on the share of the population. But I can look more into that and try and get a figure to the committee.
And a follow-up through the chair, do we have an idea of just how much of any material is recycled in Alaska? So just if we could just get sort of broad numbers on how much recycling is actually taking place in Alaska, and that would be excellent.
Representative Carrick, through the chair, we do have those numbers as far as total recycling. I can send them out to the committee after the hearing.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I guess for ACC or the bill sponsor, I was curious, are there specific companies that are looking to invest, or are we not quite looking at that yet?
Representative Fields, through the chair, I can say in the research that I've done, a lot of the large chemical companies and large oil companies like ExxonMobil are looking at investing in these facilities. They are very high capital intensive projects. To do them on a large scale
in the hundreds of millions. So mostly you're going to get large chemical companies wanting to partake in this industry. And then, Mr. Cookson, if you have anything to add on to that as far as companies looking to invest.
And if I might interject, Mr. Chair, I'm asking specifically about Alaska. Have we heard from companies looking to invest in Alaska? Thank you.
Representative Fields, through the chair, I have not talked to any companies who want to invest in Alaska. Just once again, for clarity, we're just putting the framework into place, and then we're hoping those conversations take place after it's in statute and after the DEC has created regulations. At that point in time, I would expect any sort of interested parties to start talking Alaska projects.
I did have another
question. And through the chair, Representative Fields, I would just add, this is Craig from the ACC, that pretty much every single one of our members has very, very large goals attached to producing plastics that are made from non-virgin energy sources. And so, you know, Chevron Phillips is an example. They want to produce 1 billion pounds of their Marlex and new polymers by 2030. LyondellBasell is another company that has said that they want to produce 2 million metric tons of either recycled or renewable-based polymers by 2030. That's a global number. And Shell is another one that says they want to recycle 1 million metric tons by 2025. So, and their customers are looking upstream. I mentioned before the U.S. Plastics Pact. Their customers are looking upstream and saying, look, our customers and consumers are demanding recycled content in our packaging and products. And if you cannot provide me with that recycled content, then I'm going to move on to your competitors. So the long way of saying that the race is on to capture every single pound of plastics and get that back into recycled content again, because customers, consumers, everybody is demanding it.
Okay. I have another question, Mr. Chair.
We're going to set this bill aside, Representative Fields. We'll have another opportunity. Representative McKay, thank you very much for your presentation. We will set this bill aside at this point, and we will move on to SB 123 from Senator Kaufman. We had a House companion in our committee a while back. Senator Kaufman, can you please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and explain the differences between the Senate and House versions?
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Kaufman and the Senate Transportation Committee. Senator Kaufman is on his way down from another meeting, so should be here any moment. But I'll just quickly summarize. Senate Bill 123, just like House Bill 124, repeals the state requirement that a prospective driver hold a regular U.S. driver's license for at least 1 year before they can apply for their commercial learner's permit and begin the CDL process. The only difference between this bill and the House Bill 124 is that it has an immediate effective date. And with that, that summarizes the changes.
Any members have any questions? Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Folks in my district and in Fairbanks are currently concerned about a project related to ore hauling on Alaska highways, and they say there's no substitute for experience. So is there potentially value in removing this requirement, but in still having some type of requirement around experience on road conditions similar to Alaska, for example, in the future, in order to ensure that folks are not only going through the training to get a commercial driver's license, but also have some layer of background experience in just the types of conditions that might be experienced on Alaska's highways?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, thank you so much for that question. One point of clarification, if this bill does pass, a person, prospective truck driver, would still need to get a regular Alaska driver's license before they could start their CDL process. There will be some experience needed in a normal car before they can start that process. In addition to that, for larger projects, such as the one in Fairbanks that there's been concerns raised about, In order to do that, a person will have to have 6 months of driving experience in a Class A with a Class A CDL before they can begin the training to receive the endorsement needed to haul larger trucks with ore and with more dangerous materials. We feel that with the passage of this bill and the new federal requirements that are now mandated, as well as the experience needed to get a regular driver's license, that public safety won't be impacted by this bill specifically, and that there are a lot of standards in place to ensure that somebody will be able to safely drive large vehicles on Alaska roads in Alaska-specific conditions. I believe we may also have Joey Crum from the Northern Industrial Trucking online, who might be able to speak more specifically to your question as well.
That's not necessary. We already heard from him.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS for Senate Bill 123, also referred to as 33-LS0721-B, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, without objection, Senate Bill 123 has been advanced from committee. Thank you. And thank you, Mrs. Torkelson. We'll take a brief at ease and sign the committee report. Record. Next, we have Senate Bill 93, the request of Senate Labor and Commerce. We had the House companion in our committee a little while back. Senator Bjorkman, can you please put your name on the record and explain the differences between the Senate and House versions? And also, I believe we have invited testimony from Senator Clayman.
Thank you very much, Chair Sumner, and esteemed members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I appreciate you welcoming me to your room today. The Alaska Fishermen's Fund reimburses licensed commercial fishermen and boat owners for their out-of-pocket medical costs if they have been injured or have a qualifying illness while fishing offshore or doing fishing-related work onshore. The fund's source of revenue is a portion of fees on resident and non-resident commercial fishing licenses and permits. Senate Bill 93 was introduced by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at the request of the Fishermen's Fund and Appeals Council to increase maximum allowable benefits that may be paid out from the Alaska Fishermen's Fund for qualifying injuries and illnesses. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 93, as amended by Senate Labor and Commerce, would, and the floor, make the following changes to state statute. Increases the amount payable from $10,000 to $15,000, maximum reimbursable amount for any one injury and disablement for any one heart attack or instance. Increases the amount from $5,000 to $15,000, the maximum amount paid to a vessel owner to cover their insurance deductible for a qualifying crew member illness or injury. Also, the Senate version of this bill adds viral illness to the list of occupational diseases in statute that are eligible for reimbursement as currently mandated under maritime law. The vessel owner is liable for medical costs if a crew member becomes ill while they are on board, regardless of when they contracted the illness. Also, the Senate version provides step downs in statute so that if the fund balance starts to drop, the maximum reimbursable amount for qualifying events will reduce accordingly.
Hey, thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To the chair, Senator Bjorkman, now I've been reading the background material on this, and I'm not exactly sure if the Fisherman's Fund is intended to directly reimburse a crew member for injuries, or is it designed to reimburse a captain or owner for their deductible, or in case a crew member has an injury, or is it both?
The statute and the program as it exists before any changes made by this bill does both. The fact that it does both is still included in this piece of legislation.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Prox.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Bjorkman. Were these changes made by the Senate, were they requested by the Fishermen's Fund, the folks controlling the Fishermen's Fund, or did the Senate make their own changes?
These changes were made in a floor amendment brought by Senator Matt Clayman. Senator Matt Clayman has extensive legal experience dealing with maintenance and cure and the Fisherman's Fund. He has argued before the Alaska Supreme Court specifically on this issue. And the changes made in the Clayman amendments really protect boat owners and allow them to be compensated from the fund that they pay into if there were to be a claim against their boat, which they would be required to pay.
And with Great. That, perhaps we could have Senator Clayman approach, put your name on the record, and talk to us about your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Matt Clayman from Senate District H. So, question?
Thank you. Through the chair, the question was whether the Fisherman Fund essentially requested these changes, or is this something that came out of the Senate?
I had a number of discussions both with the Department of Labor representative, I think he's here today, as well as a discussion with the chair of the Fisherman's Fund board before introducing the amendment. And we were trying to address dual concerns. One was to provide protection for fishermen, which is part of the fund is there to provide protections for Fisherman's Fund in a context in which, because certain London insurers were not covering vessel-related injuries, even though they were very much vessel-related and would come under the vessel owner's obligation to pay maintenance and cure. And so the amendment both addressed providing some coverage within the $15,000 cap that's established in the legislation that would provide some benefit to the fishermen when the vessel owner's insurance wasn't providing coverage, number one, and number two, provide protections for the fund in the unlikely event that having the additional coverage caused some significant impact on the financial health of the fund.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Clayman, I'm trying to get a sense as to whether this was the impetus of the bill was to try and account for medical inflation, or was it to account for lack of coverage by Lloyd's of COVID, or both, or I'm not sure which was the original, or were they in parallel from the start?
So that Senator Bjork may be able to answer that's a two-part question. You may get a two-person answer.
Sure. From my understanding, Representative Sadler, through the chair, the impetus of the bill was the fact that insurance deductibles across the commercial fishing industry have increased substantially, and the fund itself, the Fisherman's Fund, is quite healthy, being over $14 million. Mm-hmm. So it was the assessment of the board as well as us on the Senate side that these increase in payout amounts, when necessary, are warranted. If you we'll take a look at the fiscal note attached to the bill, the average per claim there in the fiscal note is listed at $2,300 per claim. If deductibles continue to rise and instances of medical costs do as well, the additional money available to fishermen that they pay in themselves is warranted.
So that's through the chair, that's kind of this one answer. And to what degree was the coverage or non-coverage of COVID an impetus for the bill? Is it a two-part answer?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the COVID non-coverage was brought to our attention by some different vessel owners. Purse Seine vessel owners were the first folks that notified us, but there were other fishing groups that identified it, that the London underwriters weren't covering COVID. From the conversations with Department of Labor, they indicated that COVID is largely, for purposes of claims, kind of in the rearview mirror, if you will. And the concern that Department of Labor raised was that if you found yourself with another viral illness somewhat similar to COVID that was then not being covered by the insurers, that one of the ways both to protect vessel owners, because they would still have the obligation to pay maintenance and cure even if their insurance coverage didn't cover it, the interest was to provide some benefit to fishermen who might get a illness that was not covered by their vessel owner's insurance fund, that they would have some limited benefits from the fisherman's fund that may be able to help. Part of the analysis that we also did was looking at the number of claims filed against the fund and the health of the fund. The average number of high year for claims for deductible to vessel owners tent was, I think, the highest number we saw was 25 claims for the deductible in the whole year, and a large number of claims, one of the larger number of claims by fishermen was in the 150 to 200 claims. And so looking at actually the fairly small number of claims, it was apparent that the small expansion of coverage to the viral illnesses that were related to coverage incidents on the vessel and that would not put the fund at risk in any way. That you'd have to go from 250 claims to 5,000 claims, and they'd have to be at the $15,000 cap before you'd really start seeing a significant impact on the health of the fund. And so, because part of the goal of the fund is to provide protection to fishermen while also maintaining the strength of the fund, the step-down approach was a way to strike that balance to provide some security for the fund, but also have a slight expansion in the coverage. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the important features to note is that the obligation to pay maintenance and cure is much broader, which is the vessel owner's obligation. It's much broader than any coverage within the fisherman's fund. So I won't go through the list, but you could easily come up with 15 conditions that would be covered by the obligation to pay maintenance and cure that, whether with this expansion in the fund coverage or without, those would not be covered by the fisherman's fund.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, do I understand correctly that the boat owners, I guess, are obligated to pay for viruses, whether the virus was contracted on the boat or not? Is that the correct understanding?
That's through the chair, Representative Prox. That's correct. The maritime obligation to pay maintenance and cure, which dates back to the pre-revolutionary days in our country, and the earliest articulation of that duty was by Justice Story in the early 1800s, talks about the very, very broad obligation to provide maintenance and cure, and that's a much, much broader obligation than the Fisherman's Fund obligation. And it's so broad that nothing we could do legislatively would take away from the breadth of that coverage for maintenance and cure.
Thank you for the history lesson, Senator. Representative Sadler.
Do we have any testimony, and forgive me if it's in the packet, from the Fishermen's Advisory Board, is it the appeal board, the governing board, as to whether they think that the COVID coverage is viral, but it's COVID, would be an untenable financial burden on the Fishermen's Fund, i.e. break the fund? And I'm not quite sure if we have a position by the Fishermen's Fund Advisory Board on this or not.
We have noticed public testimony, and I believe we may receive some.
I do note that one of the first bits of documentation I have is from the Fisherman's Fund people, but it's back in 2022, and I don't think it covered COVID at that point. So I guess I'll wait and hear the public testimony.
Okay. Other questions for the bill presenter or Senator Klayman? No? Seeing none? Okay. We will go ahead and open public testimony on SB 93. I see online we have a Clay Bezanek. Mr. Bezanek, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. My name is Clay Besnick. I am a member of the Fisherman's Fund Appeal and Advisory Board. Sorry I didn't get that to the guy that put me into the conference here. And for the record, I'm not we don't have a chairman position. I'm just the old guy on the board. And I talked to Senator Klayman about the problems that we had and tried to come to some kind of solution. But this bill, a little bit of quick history, because I know you guys have had a long day. We started this bill out with a $10,000 full return to the boat owner's deductible that was the impetus of this bill to start out with, and it went to $15,000. And then it had COVID and all viruses attached to it. And now our board meets in the fall, and we meet in the spring. So this happened after our board met last fall and before we met in the spring. And basically, we had 1 hour with the insurance industry to discuss this, and then we're just hop-skipping, trying to figure something out on the run without our board together discussing it like we do when we come up with things that we bring to you guys. So at this time, we have no consensus on this. We understand the issue, but I think it was last Thursday the World Health Organization said COVID is no longer a problem. So we're kind of, we can't support the virus part of this bill. Although we don't want any vessel owners to be on the hook for anything, we don't feel at this time that we can support this. So we'd like to discuss more with the insurance industry, maybe come up with something we can bring to you next year. But we've had plenty of time to discuss the issue with them, but they have made a huge go to try to meet with us. So that's all I got from here. I'm open to questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Besnick. We'll go to the room. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 93? No? Okay. We will close public testimony. Okay. Representative Sadler.
Is it still possible to ask Mr. Besnick a question?
I believe he's still on. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Mr. Besnick, are you still on the line, sir?
Yeah, I am.
Hey, through the chair, I wanted to ask you, you spoke to essentially saying that the schedule of your board's meeting kind of deprived you of the opportunity to give due consideration to this. Would your meeting schedule provide you enough time over the next 7 months or so to consider this and come up with a consensus position on this bill?
I can't speak for the board. Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I can't speak for the rest of the board members or the insurance agency or Senator Klayman, but we would be open to, anything. The fund was made for people that got hurt out fishing, and we kind of figure that Lloyd's of London, and we kind of feel really nervous about getting the world dumped in our lap, right? But we are open to discussing and working on this with anybody that wants to approach us, okay?
And through the chair, what I was trying to get to is, does the meeting schedule allow for you to meet and discuss this during regular order? I'm not asking you to presuppose a conclusion or a consensus, but does your schedule of meeting allow you sufficient time to consider this properly?
Well, Chuck and Velma, our Department of Labor people, are there, but I would think it does, yeah, as a board member.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess the bill as it existed, the House version, is that urgent enough that we should take action on that part of the bill this year and come back next year and discuss the Senate amendments?
Are you speaking with me, Representative?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we support the House version. Yeah, we 100% do. The Senate version, at this time, we have angst with it, okay?
Okay, follow-up? For sake of strategy, I guess, is the House version something that would do you some good this year if it was passed, as opposed to waiting on the whole bill and discussing the whole bill next year?
100%. We would appreciate if the House version was passed, yes.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Representative Fields.
I just didn't know if any of the organizations that had submitted letters in support of the Senate version wanted to comment on why. I do have to pick up my girls at daycare in a few minutes, so if we were going to take action today, I'd appreciate the opportunity to vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Senate Bill number 93, version S.A, also referred to as 33-LS053-S.A, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And I guess I would object.
Okay, there is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
Pass.
Representative Sadler.
Pass.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. And so with six yeas and one nay, House Bill 93 has moved, Senate Bill 93 has moved from committee. We will take a brief at ease and shuffle folks around. Back on the record. Last Friday, we had three bills from Representative Prox in committee that we held until he was back. Now we're going to bring those up. Representative Wright. Starting with House Bill 137, does anybody have any questions for Representative Wright? No? No questions? Okay. Vice Chair Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS versus, I would move House Bill number 137, version A, also referred to as 33-LS0680-A, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
Okay, there's objection. Representative Sadler?
Just want to call the roll.
Any last words, Representative Wright? No? Call the roll, please.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. So with six yeas and no nays, House Bill 137 has passed from committee. Next, House Bill 138. Does anyone have any questions for Representative Wright? No? Okay. Representative Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 138, version A, also referred to as 33-LS0681-A, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Check.
Okay, there is objection. Representative Sadler, would you like to speak to your objection?
I want to hear the roll.
Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. So with six yeas and zero nays, House Bill 138 has advanced from committee. Last on the agenda today is House Bill 145. Does anyone have any questions for Representative Wright? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. For the record, I don't have 145. Just remind me, what the bill is, this the payday bill?
Yes.
Short title, please.
Yes, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 145, version U, also referred to as 33-LS0508-U, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Sure.
Okay, there is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carey.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
No. So with five yeas and one nay, House Bill 145 has advanced from committee. That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:13 p.m.